Hi, I'm Aislinn Antrim with Pharmacy Times. Welcome to Psychedelic Pharmacy, where we take a look at one of the fastest growing markets in healthcare, psychedelic medicine.
This month, we'll hear part one of an interview with Kelsey Ramsden, co-founder, president, and CEO at MindCure, about the DESIRE project and the potential use of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for the treatment of women with hypoactive sexual desire disorder, or HSDD. In an interview with Pharmacy Times, Ramsden said sexual health is directly linked with mental health, and both issues are often under-investigated in women. Because of this, the DESIRE project is directly focusing on this patient population. Just a quick trigger warning, this episode does deal with themes of sexual trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. So, Kelsey, what is the DESIRE project and what are its intended goals?
Right. So I call it the DESIRE project, or we call it the DESIRE project, because there's really two parts to it. One is the clinical research program, which I'm assuming we're going to spend a lot of our time talking about. And the other piece, though, is this cultural narrative talking about women in desire that we don't typically explore. So for us, the work is both on having conversations about women in desire that don't make us immediately think of someone in high heels or, you know, this idea that every woman should have access to desire, whether or not it's Friday night or kind of Tuesday afternoon in her Lululemon pants. And then this second piece, which is really the clinical research program, which is MDMA and psychotherapy combined to address really what we believe to be the root of a mental health disorder, as opposed to just a physiological situation.
Can you explain what HSDD is and how it is currently treated?
So typically when people think hypoactive, they think more for some reason. So we're actually talking about a lack versus hyper, which is too much. So hypoactive means a lack of sexual desire for women. And I'll paint a little bit of a picture. So 40% of women, and this is North American stats, predominantly focused on the US, 40% of women, premenopausal women, will experience some prolonged term of a lack of desire. They complain about it. 14% of women of the total population, premenopausal, experience a lack of desire to the degree to which it has a negative impact on their life, mental health outcomes, experiential outcomes. So that's about 9.5 million women in the States, just in the States. And what this means, though, we just talk about like negative outcome, lack of desire. These are really amorphous. So let's drive down into it a little bit more. A lack of desire, when we define desire, that's everything from kind of thoughts of fantasy or interest all the way up to arousal. So we're not talking about, you know, getting to orgasm. That's another storyline. It has a good ending, but that's not the arena we're playing in. We're playing in this arena of everything prior to, which can include response to physical attention or none whatsoever. Doesn't have to apply to people who are partnered in any way. Single people can experience desire on their own. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about desire. Hypoactive sexual desire disorder can be a result of other medications. So people who are on SSRIs for a prolonged period of time can experience a lack of desire. So we're not addressing the folks for whom lacking desire is a side effect of another medication. Let's put that to the side. And we're not addressing the folks who have a hormonal imbalance. So for some folks, their testosterone and estrogen can be off. That can be a place to look. So let's put them to the side. Let's just focus on the folks who have lived experience that might have negatively impacted their relationship to self and other. So that may look like the women who have had a history of sexual assault or abuse. It may look like the women who, by 1,000 cuts, have had a history of living in society that can be challenging for women. It can may look like a woman who has a hard time connecting to herself in a way and having that esteemed self enough to really be present in her own desire. So there's a bit of a, well, there's a lot of women who fall into those categories, if we're honest. And on the market, there are two drugs that treat the physiology, not the psychology, both of which have only come out in about the last 8-10 years and perform just slightly better than placebo, with some side effects that not everybody likes, like nausea and that kind of thing. So, and they're pretty expensive and you take them forever. So for us, looking at the opportunity to be of service was this idea around what can we bring that maybe women don't have to take a pill or a shot or something every single day, and that maybe can get beyond the symptoms and really address the root cause.
How does MDMA-assisted psychotherapy come into play in helping to address hypoactive sexual desire disorder in women?
So I'll introduce first MDMA. So some folks who are listening are thinking, isn't that a drug, like a street drug? Isn't that something we used in the 90s at raves? And so in some respects, my answer to that would be yes. A lot of people are familiar with MDMA. And there has been a fair amount of research done with MDMA outside of our anecdotal college experiences. There's an organization that some folks might be familiar with called MAPS, or the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And on the cover of the New York Times just a couple of months ago was their phase 3 study announcing the data coming out of utilizing MDMA with psychotherapy to treat PTSD. And that data was really promising. So that, you know, for us has also helped to inform our protocol for the study, but is informing how we can reorient to MDMA as a pharmaceutical drug and not a good time drug. But what we know that MDMA does is it's among this group of empathogens and entactogens. So it floods the brain with serotonin in a way that allows us access to a greater amount of empathy for ourselves and others. It kind of provides what I would almost say like a dreamlike state. So we're able to separate all of our judgments, kind of disassociate from this having to protect our ego, and really be able to consider new ways of seeing things, new ways of being. And so that's, I think, the most common piece of the experience of MDMA. And when we talk about MDMA and psychotherapy, you know, I missed an important point for the listener, which is this is done in a clinical setting with a therapist or two therapists in the room with you. These sessions last over a number of hours. And in psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, a large component of the important work is the set and the setting. So what that looks like is imagine yourself showing up, and of course you're gonna do some intakes and there'll be some pre-sessions to prep you. But once you get into the room, you may be on some kind of like a chaise lounge or a couch or something like that. And then I don't know if you've ever slept in an airplane and they give you those kind of like eye shades, or maybe your grandma wore them or whatever the case, you're given a pair like that, and then headphones, and there's specific music or playlist that plays. So once the MDMA is on board, the patient will experience this kind of opening up and empathetic experience where they might start, having had set an intention before the session, they'll start exploring those areas that they're seeking to heal. And they'll be listening to music. But in those moments that they want to connect with their therapist, they can, of course, take up their shades and take off the headphones and kind of be here now. We're not talking about psychedelics from the 60s where we're like, whoa, man, you know, like we're at a Pink Floyd concert, different context. So really driving at this idea of what does that look like and why do we think MDMA can work? We have the experience of MAPS to inform what that therapeutic container can look like. We have de-risked by virtue of understanding how MDMA assisted by psychotherapy can look over a course of treatment of 3 months. And our team of researchers includes one of the lead researchers on that MDMA project, as well as the two most well-cited researchers in sexual desire for women, one of which you actually defined the diagnostic tool. So all told, we think that MDMA and psychotherapy can really drive at where lack of desire sits at its roots for women. And like I said before, you know, really treat at the origin as opposed to just the symptoms in coming out of it.
Does HSDD primarily occur in women, or are men also affected?
Yeah, men can be affected. Good point. I'm glad that you tied into that, because there are lots of drugs on the market for the fellas and their fulsome experience of sexuality and desire, but very few for women. And I thought that it might be time for us to focus on something in a segment of the market that would be directed at those of us who might experience that. But that notwithstanding, yes, men can experience a lack of sexual desire. So the same could very much apply to them. And we may find that in future iterations of research. And it is also, I think, important to note that you can have an acquired hypoactive sexual desire disorder, in that if your partner has it, you can acquire it over time. And some of that can look like, let's just create a narrative where, say, my spouse is disinterested in sex, and I make advances and I'm turned down, and I make advances and I'm turned down. And over time, that may erode my own sense of self and my own esteem and my own orientation to desire, and that I've been taught that it's not right or it's wrong or it's not for me. So then I can acquire it, having had been with a partner who has it. And that's not to say that all men's lack of desire is acquired. They, you know, in many regards are just like women. I think part of this conversation, the B side of the Desire Project, but the very important part, is having that open conversation. Like, I think there's a narrative in society where we talk about men and maybe don't frame them with having as much emotion and connection as they do. So absolutely, this context of hypoactive sexual desire disorder can occur in men and does. But, you know, I think there's time for the ladies. So we're gonna make space for that.
With this in mind, why is the Desire Project so directly focused on women?
Okay, I'm going to answer this in two ways. The first way is to say, if you're a fella and you're listening, we're not demonizing you. So Viagra is, I think, the most smashing drug out there on the market. And pretty much everyone's familiar with what it does and has heard at least, you know, one joke made at someone's expense around the table with respect to Viagra. And Viagra was not intended to be an erectile dysfunction drug. It wasn't like a bunch of fellas were sitting around in the lab and thought, how can we make our sex lives better, guys? It was a heart drug. And it just so happened that some of the patients involved in the research study were going, there's this other thing that seems to be happening and is worth mentioning. And then, of course, you know, the folks in the research lab went, well, this could work. Maybe beyond a heart drug, we're looking at an erectile dysfunction drug. So that's how Viagra was born. So I often like to start this conversation because there is this kind of part that can go, oh, this is another men versus women. And it really isn't. It's just that, you know, kind of falling off the bench at the lab happened to be a few more things for the fellows that came in advance. That notwithstanding, I think the second part of this, though, is that we are, as a society, way more comfortable with men having desire than we are with women. Like, even in this may be, you know, a little bit edgy. So if you're driving and listening to this in the car with the kids, just pause for a moment. When we think of women in desire, societally, we tend to close our eyes and think of someone who may be younger than 30, someone who may look a certain way, someone who may be behaving in certain ways, dress certain ways. Well, there's this whole narrative around women and what's desirous that has been created in our North American culture. When you go to other cultures, that looks a little bit different. But so it's uncomfortable addressing this, because that also demands that we have some of these conversations, which is, is it okay for the lady who checked your groceries out to be someone who has access to desire? Like, is that a thing we can consider culturally? Could it be okay that I'll use myself as an example. I'm a mother of three children. I'm 45 years old. Everything doesn't look the same way it used to in another time. And, but yet I have a rich future ahead of me of sexual experience with my partner or partners. And I should have every right to experience desire for myself. And we know that sexual health is and informs a part of mental health. If you've had a run of having a healthy connection to self and other and experienced desire, we know that that just makes the sun a little bit sunnier and tough days at work a little bit easier and all of these kind of things. So, you know, to answer your question directly, why are there more drugs for men? I think in part it was just happenstance. I think in part it's culture. And I know that even through the feedback we've got in these very early days of the Desire Project, our culture has shifted to be open to this part of the conversation. Women are kind of stepping forward and up and saying, hey, Me Too wasn't just about this fact that so many women experience negative sexual or relational issues. The Me Too is, I want to be considered as a person who not only is, you know, able to access, but deserves to be seen in desire without it having to become hypersexualized and kind of over the top and only for these people. I'll share a little anecdote. My grandma was 97 when she passed away. And like at many funerals, there's a bunch of pictures of the person who was in your life. And here's this picture of my grandma. And I'd never seen it before. And I'm going to say she was probably, maybe she's 30 in it. And so it's like the early 50s, even late 40s. And she's wearing one of those bathing suits the gals wore then, like black, very boxy, don't show anything, like kind of whatever. But she's on the beach and she's sitting a bit on a towel with her legs are out. And she's looking at the camera. And this look, I had never seen such a thing from my grandmother before. And it was not sexualized, but it was her, it was desire. It was just the purest form of her femininity and womanhood in looking at whoever was taking this picture. I hope it was my grandpa. I don't know who it was. But this me seeing in her something that was so fully her connected. And it just, I was like, whew, that for every woman to be seen and to see themselves. Just, I mean, if we can help people do that, I think a great future can be where both men and women can be held in that place without it becoming over-sexualized, you know, with it being a part of our human experience. Because sexual health is a part of mental health, and it's just that simple.
In addition to the modern research around psychedelic medicine, the history of medicine is full of fascinating findings and alternative approaches to both medical practice and drug research. Each episode will explore a historical approach to medicine that, despite its sometimes odd or bizarre nature, remains foundational to modern developments in the field.
While we're on the subject of women's health, childbirth has historically been a difficult and dangerous undertaking with relatively few major medical developments. Although childbirth remains a difficult and often stressful experience for mothers, the advent of opioid medication and proper sanitation methods has made it far safer than.
Thanks for listening to Psychedelic Pharmacy, a pharmacy focused series.
In the United States, the first recorded
C-section. Tune in next month to hear more about this fascinating field of
research. In the Western Journal of Medical and Physical Sciences. In the journal, Dr. John L. Richman described how, after many hours of labor, he could see that the expectant mother was close to death. Using a crooked pair of scissors and his finger, he conducted the C-section. As he proceeded with the process, Richman found that he had additional trouble due to the size of the infant. He then made the decision that, quote, a childless mother was better than a motherless child, unquote, and went about trying to save the mother's life. In this effort, he was successful. Research into childbirth and women's health overall has been historically lacking, leading to gaps in evidence to support common interventions during childbirth, according to researcher Amy Brown at Swansea University. In her book on the subject, Brown said that although 10% of women become pregnant each year, just 2% of research funding is spent on pregnancy research. Expanding research into underrepresented groups, such as women and communities of color, is essential to gain the full picture of medicine in the United States.
Thanks for listening to Psychedelic Pharmacy, a pharmacy-focused series. Tune in next month to hear part 2 of this fascinating discussion with Kelsey Ramsden.